we go back to this notion of complex adaptive systems, you can't script every moment, right? Like you cannot possibly come up with the algorithm or the sheet music that would suggest that this is exactly how it's going to go. People are imperfect. Systems are imperfect.
I'm Daniel Atlin. Welcome to Messy. We have conversations with leaders about how they navigate and make sense of the mess they find themselves in. Hospitals are some of the messiest systems we have. High stakes, under pressure, and filled with deeply human decisions. These institutions, vital to any community, sit at the intersection of politics, policy, funding, emotion, and human vulnerability. Few leadership roles are more complex than that of a hospital CEO. Today, I'm joined by someone who understands that complexity intimately. Since April 2023, Mark Walton has served as the president and CEO of Guelph General Hospital. He's a leader with decades of public and private sector experience across Ontario's health system, from the Ministry of Health to hospital operations to system-level transformation roles. Mark is known for his steady, relational approach, his instinct for navigating competing pressures, and for leading through crisis with both discipline and humanity. During the pandemic, Mark served as Senior Vice President, COVID-19 Pandemic Response, an important and complicated role in a system and society in distress. The public healthcare system in Canada, and in other jurisdictions too, of course, continues to be under immense stress due to societal demands, demographic shifts, funding challenges, and trying to keep up with technological innovations. At Guelph General, Mark is guiding the hospital through extraordinary demand, workforce challenges, major capital expansion, and the ongoing work of building a culture where people can do their best work despite the mess around them. Welcome to Messy, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.
I'm very fond of the quote from Kierkegaard, you know, that I came across, that lives can only be understood backwards, but must be lived forwards. Would you like to take us a little bit through your reflection on your journey and how you ended up in this important current role?
Oh, for sure, I'd be happy to. And I like the Kierkegaard quote. And I think he's right in theory. And I was even reflecting on it a bit in practice as a hospital CEO. Some days it feels like you can only sort of understand things backwards to the best of your ability, because you're always working with imperfect information, both past, present, and future. You got to plan forwards, and frankly, your inbox is chock full of every time frame possible, future, present, and backwards. So I think he's right on the money, and I would say if he lived in 2025, he'd probably understand that statement even more vividly. But looking back at my work that I have done over my almost 40 years in healthcare now, it started really when I was 17. My mother was a nurse at the then Mississauga Hospital, and she gave me an indication that there was a ward clerk position in the emergency department there. Ward clerk is effectively a unit secretary, somebody who helps to coordinate all of the comings and goings. And this was at the emergency department, and it was my first exposure to healthcare in a major way. And I was enamored. I was captured by it almost immediately. I was watching people respond to code blues, cardiac arrests. I was looking at people rallying around patients and situations, and I knew I needed to be a part of that. And I was fortunate enough in that role, somebody kindly introduced me down the hallway to the administrative wing, because they knew I didn't want to be a clinician. I was not into the blood and guts and bodily fluids that some people can tolerate, not me. So they took me down to the admin wing, and I learned that there was a career path to this through a master's program and other things. And went home that night and I said to my parents, I know what I want to be. I want to be a hospital CEO. And this was at about 19 years old.
Wow, and that's incredible. It really was.
I had a very clear sense of what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. But it wasn't until 2023 that I actually, well, 2022, I got the call from Guelph General Hospital after I'd gone through the interview process. I happened to be doing some Christmas shopping right around this time of year. And I got the call and I heard that I got the job as the CEO at Guelph General Hospital. And I stopped and I actually cried. I was standing in the middle of a Canadian Tire, because it was a full circle moment for me.
Wow.
Where that 17-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid got to sort of realize that trajectory that he'd been on. And it's been a long trajectory. And I would say, looking back, it's been a continuous journey. I think Kierkegaard was right. Like, to really understand how I got here, you got to look backwards. And I would say that entire journey, I've just been building muscles to hold complexity, to translate between worlds, and frankly, to keep patients at the center of a system where it sometimes feels impossible to do that.
That's amazing. I love the fact that, you know, you knew what you wanted to be, but the path you took was actually a little bit circuitous and had probably a little bit of a unforeseen sort of journeys. And that's so much like what life is. And that's just fantastic.
Well, and appropriately so, it's quite messy, to be honest with you. It was a meandering path, to your point. And I would say I've moved through private sector, public sector, government, provincial, local. None of it was a straight line, but I'll tell you, I learned something in every single instance. And I think that's what has allowed me to serve the organization at this point in time in the way that I do.
Now, I guess that the title messy actually resonates with you as well. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how you see that, you know, relating to your current role and your journey as well.
Well, I would say that the public sector right now, and I would include a variety of different organizations in this description beyond healthcare and hospitals. You've got universities, you've got Ontario health teams, family practices, governments, crown agencies. You know, these are all organizations that are funded by the Ontario or the Canadian taxpayer. And they're all in a really challenging situation right now. And I would say population growth being what it is, services continue to go up, but the rate at which we are able to raise taxes and to pay for those services is not going up commensurate to that. And I would say, you know, often when you hear this discussion, it starts off very much with a comparison of public versus private organizations. And in some ways, I think there's almost a natural jump to publicly held organizations are broken corporations, like not as good as private sector. And I would say they're not broken corporations, universities, hospitals, government agencies. They're just a different species of organization. They're mission driven. And while we do have our bottom lines, and that's really where we're feeling a bit of the pinch right now is financially, we've got to balance quality, patient experience, staff well-being, community trust, donors, regulators. It is a very messy system that we work in with a lot of competing interests. And I would say the greatest competing interest is actually the growth rate and the disease rate that is going to be coming upon us, because it's going to demand more, not less, of those organizations. And frankly, we're sitting right in the middle of it, trying to figure out how we pay for all of this, how we deliver it well, and continue to meet the growth in our population.
No question about that. I think we see a tsunami now of people actually who are my age and a little bit older, perhaps, who are needing, you know, services, but also, you know, illness is getting more complex as well. And while we've done a great job, I think, of keeping people healthy for longer, you know, there's more complexity to those illnesses. And of course, you factor in the mental health issues on top of that, and the relationship between those two things, it becomes even more messy.
Well, and we know as dollars get tighter, inflation goes up, people are in more precarious housing, under housing situations. All of those determinants of health get pressure. They start to crack, and that's when people start to get sick. And so, you know, I will always argue, obviously, for my hospital to get as much funding as it possibly can to serve our population. But I also recognize every one of those other agencies that I've mentioned are also struggling to keep their heads above water, and they play a vital role in our society. And, you know, when we don't have education, when we don't have food security, when we don't have housing, people get sick. And then guess what? They end up in my emergency department. So getting ahead of some of this stuff is tricky too.
And hospitals never stop. So what's it actually like, you know, to lead in a system where the work is literally 24/7 and it's people's lives are at stake? And what do you think people actually misunderstand actually about how hospitals function? So there's sort of two questions there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we learn a lot about things through television, you know, whether you're watching Grey's Anatomy, or currently there's something called The Pitt that's on there, you know, a lot of dramatization around healthcare and what people believe going in hospitals. I will say a lot of the shows nowadays are incredibly accurate in terms of the, you know, terminology, technology, things along those lines. But I would say there's a real emotional reality to working in healthcare. And I would say there is never a moment where someone under our care at the hospital isn't suffering, isn't facing something that could potentially change their life's trajectory for better or for worse, where a life is beginning and somewhere else a life is ending. Like, all of that is happening under our roof on a daily basis. And, you know, I lost my dad about 5 years ago, and I can appreciate the drama of that single instance, the impact that it had on me, the impact that it had on our family. And I have to recognize and remind myself every day, those moments happen in our hospital. And it's good moments too. Babies come into this world. There's a lot of celebrations that happen in our place. But I would say stepping back and really thinking about the gravity and the importance of the services we have, I'm not sure everybody really understands the weight that brings. And I would say it's on our clinicians and the people at the front line who are caring for those patients. But you also have a lot of people and leaders within those organizations that are just trying to do a good job every day, trying to move forward, trying to provide that care. And, you know, I would say that people look at us and they'll say, it's a building. Everything happens between those four walls. But think about the paramedics bringing people into our organization. That's where it starts. It even starts before that with community organizations that might be supporting that family as they leave us, long-term care homes, home care, all of that sort of stuff. We are part of an ecosystem of care. And I think people often think about hospitals as just having total control over the inputs and the outputs. We don't, actually. What shows up on our doorstep on a daily basis is completely different. And we adapt. We are a very complex adaptive system at the hospital. And I would say that brings along with it its own challenges, but no one day is the same. And I'm not sure everybody recognizes that. Even as an administrator, I do not have a day that goes by that isn't different in some way and an issue that presents itself that isn't completely unique.
You're mentioning that it's a complex adaptive system, and it's part of other systems too, right, that actually are connected to it too. And very similar, I think, in a lot of ways to a university where people have great expectations, but, assumptions as well that sometimes don't hold true, actually, when you scratch away at the surface.
And every person who comes through the door, you know, I get a lot more compliments than I do complaints. And the compliments always come back to people, come back to our staff, the way that they interact with them. And what I would say is I think our staff do recognize that something profound or terrible or amazing could be happening to those people in that very good moment, in that moment. And even though we've seen that type of thing 10,000 times, this is their first experience with it. And our staff are incredibly good at meeting people at where they're at. And I think that's a really important element of sort of how we try to adapt in that complex system.
Well, and during the pandemic, the healthcare system, after years of optimization and efficiency, was suddenly faced with tremendous demand and challenges. And it's a system that was at a breaking point, but couldn't and didn't break. And we're still dealing, of course, with that stretching and the fractures that were caused now, 5 years later. What did you learn about that during your time, in a very different role, actually, during that pandemic?
It was an incredible time. And I say incredible, perhaps in the broadest definition of the sense, incredible meaning also terrible in its enormity, right? Like, there were just so many things about it that were incredible and horrible. Couple things that I learned, and I would say maybe putting a bit of the leadership role on it, I had responsibility for coordinating the response of Ontario Health, which was about 22 different health agencies, including oversight of the incident management system for Ontario. And every day was different. But, we look at it now in 2025. And if I go back to 2020 and think about what could have we done, what should have we done, how might have we done things differently, I do so now with perfect knowledge. I do so now with the view that we know what the vaccines are capable of. We have vaccines, we have face masks, all that sort of thing. But if we go back to March of 2020, we were dominated by fear and very little fact. We didn't know how it was transmitted. We didn't know its virology. We didn't know how deadly it would be. We could only look across the seas to Italy or some other nation to find out that it was decimating generations of older adults. And so we prepared accordingly. And one of the lessons I learned at that point in time was when people were frightened and scared, it was very important for you to say, here's what we know, but it may be wrong in the next 4 hours, right? To say, I don't know, is an incredibly authenticating experience for people when a leader says that. And I would say, I saw a lot of leaders who tried to have all the answers, and in fact, it hurt their credibility. Saying, I don't know, sometimes is a really important admission. People can at least then accept, we'll do our best and we'll keep you updated. But that was a really key piece. The other thing that I learned was, you know, at the beginning, everybody was bashing pots and pans and, you know, cheering on our healthcare workers. And that sort of died an unceremonious death, so to speak, later on in the pandemic. People got a little angrier, perhaps a little bit more jaded about some of the mandates that were out there. But we talked about our healthcare folks as heroes. And I do believe that they were heroes. But that term, while it offered pride, it also made it harder for them to admit exhaustion and to ask for help. And I still see the weariness in people's eyes, in the way that they engage, in the way that they step up. It's different than it was prior to the pandemic, because I think we hurt some of our people. And I say that in the sense that we asked a lot of them, and being the great people that they were, they didn't ask much of us. And so I see it now. And I think sometimes we need to acknowledge that healthcare personnel are heroes. There's no question. But in that, there's also a degree of responsibility and invulnerability that they like to portray that I just don't think is true. They need to help as much as anybody else. And I think some people are still wearing that. And of course, we're trying to support them as best we can. But something I learned is I think you've got to find space for those heroes to collapse once in a while.
Well, that's really, I think, important for people to hear, especially, you know, with lived trauma, I'd say that a lot of the professionals in those heroes went through, speaking to others who've gone through that, you know, it's still actually in some ways a little bit of a scar in their memory that they keep with them every day.
Without question. And I even know for myself, I was in it for about 3.5 years, managing sort of at the provincial level. And I can't even profess to know what it meant at the front line in many ways, because I did get to do it somewhat from a distance. But for me, those 3.5 years are a blur. And if you were to ask me about a specific situation, I could probably pull it out of my data banks. But right now, if you just said, what did you do during those 3 years? I'd say, I'm not really sure. And I think that's actually very, very consistent with what other people would talk about. It's a bit of PTSD. I think it's a little bit of mental exhaustion. And perhaps it's just our body's way of saying we don't want to remember too much. But, you know, I will say I've never seen the system rally harder and work harder to ensure the safety of our communities. And I still remain incredibly proud, despite the fact we might not have gotten it all perfect in hindsight. I think everybody did their best.
And it comes back to that improvisation you actually started, you know, the conversation with too. You know, you have to be a very good at improvisation. And I think that the pandemic was actually a great example of improvising every day. As you say, with incomplete information, with not knowing how the what the government would say, you know, on a day-to-day basis, how the new variant of the virus was coming along, so you were facing with that as well. So incredibly difficult.
And every wave was different, right? Like when we think about it, every wave was different. It hit our older generations first. And then as we moved, that was wave one, and wave two was pretty nasty around that as well. And that's where we started to see the lockdowns, et cetera. By the time we got to wave four, it started hitting our staff. That was Omicron. I remember all these Delta variants and Omicron and all of these things. And, you know, I would just say, in as much as it was one sustained pandemic, there were different flavors to every wave that came through. And while we had a lot of things in place, it kept requiring us to adapt. And that's exhausting. It's exhausting.
Well, on that sort of theme of exhaustion, I guess, you know, it must be challenging to turn off, you know, when you actually have a job that actually never stops and you're at an institution that never stops. So how do you relax and how do you take on other identities, you know, other than you being, you know, a hospital CEO?
It's funny. I'm a single dad. I have 5 kids. And so that does take up a lot of my time in terms of supporting them. Now, most of them are moving into young adulthood and university, college, or on their way into the workforce. So that role is changing in and of itself. And I would say, you know, I kind of had to face myself and say, well, what is it that I'm going to be beyond sort of the every now and then dad? Because they just need you in different ways. And, you know, do I just want to throw all my extra time into work? And I don't think that's the right answer either. So during the pandemic and post-pandemic, I started to get and rediscover a bit of love of music. And so I have found that for me, spending time on music is incredibly therapeutic. It helps get what's in my head down on paper. I compose, I write, I produce. And to be honest with you, it's incredibly therapeutic for me. And I find that in those moments when I'm feeling stressed out operationally, very tactically at work, this is the thing that kind of takes me away. And I could sit down and 8 hours later, I look up and I've just been doing exactly what I love to be doing, which is sitting down with music. It's something I discovered as a young man. I was in music all through high school and university. When kids came along, it kind of went to the side, but I've really discovered it. And I would say, you know, in some ways, there's a lot of parallels between that and what I do on a day-to-day basis, which is, you know, I kind of serve as a bit of a conductor for the whole organization. But, you know, not to get too prescriptive about the analogy, but I would say we're playing jazz. We're not playing classical because I give them the baseline structure around how we're going to play this song. But there's a lot of improvising going on out there and finding our way through it. So, you know, I do see some parallels to it, but it is an absolute gift that I get to do this and sit down and enjoy it. And we're also at a point in time where technology allows you to do it right from a computer. You don't have to go into a major studio anymore. And it's pretty fantastic.
And this someone said, like, you know, just like art, it gives you, you know, a doorway to a different world as well, right? So it's another place. It's another way for you to sort of, you know, express yourself and communicate in different ways.
It is. And you know, I think I'm not terribly open about it because, you know, music's sort of a deeply personal endeavor. It's out there. I mean, it's, you can hear it on some of the streaming platforms. But I think for me, it's a manner by which I can process things, issues, feelings, you know, some of these complex human condition elements that we deal with every day, and healthcare deals with a lot of them. And, you know, how do you work those through sometimes? And sometimes words are difficult, but music conveys a certain sense of emotion along with words. And to me, it's magical. And, you know, I would say the other piece that I find really energizing, and I often talk to executives routinely about the level of energy that they bring to their roles, because our organizations require us to be optimistic, to be energetic, to see opportunity where everybody else sees, you know, challenges. And one of the things that gives me great, great energy beyond doing music is actually talking to young people. And so I also serve as an adjunct professor with U of G, do guest lecturing with a variety of other organizations, including McMaster. And I got to tell you, you go into those classrooms where you've got young students and they have hope and optimism and they're curious. There's an energy there that you just can't. I wish we could bottle it, because I'd have it every day. But I find that to be incredibly good use of time. And I would say to any CEO or senior executive that's feeling a little bit down or a little burnt out, go talk to the younger generation. You'll see a lot of hope there.
Absolutely. And that's a great thing to be able to do and to think about actually the next generation, how they're going to be, you know, experiencing the world and addressing the problems and challenges as well. Now, you are in a system that's actually going through a lot of deep challenges. So how do you actually keep going as well? Do you have a peer group or a community of practice as well that sort of, you know, allows you to actually connect with people and help you get along the way?
It's kind of all of the above. We absolutely have a number of different groups that we work with, and whether it's around operations or strategy or, you know, best practices, all hospitals are part of these community of practices, and we share and swap ideas. How are you, you know, everybody's got the same kind of problem. It manifests a bit differently in every hospital, but same sorts of problems. So we have those types of forums, but unquestionably, I would say again, my own learning about this job, stepping into this role, is being a CEO is a lonely job. And I don't say that as a self-pity exercise. There are things you cannot share within your organization, things that you know and that you need to work through in order to position your organization well. And often those are conversations that are reserved for you and your senior leadership team or your board, and sometimes not even with them. You've got to just work it through. And so I have found it to be incredibly helpful to talk to other CEOs, other hospital CEOs, because they bear the same burden. And often what they will say is you come to them with a problem and they'll say, well, I haven't seen that thing exactly, but I've smelled something like it. You know, there's a hint of something there that I've seen before. And it's never a clean, precise solution that we come up with. But through those discussions, I always learn something about an approach. And there's also a bit of sense making that goes on, which is to say, you're not crazy. You are experiencing exactly what everybody else is, and you're not alone. And I'd say that is probably the greatest benefit that you have when you speak to those other CEOs and peer groups, is you don't feel so alone in the complexity that you're dealing with, because everybody is at the same time.
Sometimes you just need an opportunity to voice what you're going through too, I think, in order for people to feel validated, right?
Yeah, you know, you sort of can name it, then you can tame it.
It's true.
Say, you know, part of it is just trying to articulate a little bit of, you know, it always comes back to me, and so often in many of the forums that I sit with folks talking about these things, everybody's talking, everybody's giving their perspectives, but you ultimately have to go back to the question, what's the problem we're trying to solve here? And often in healthcare, it is not obvious. Right. If we say we're trying to improve health status, well, of who? In what situation? Across what board? You know, and as you dig down into the root causes, some of them get very, very specific around the problems that you're trying to solve. But I think that's one of the biggest challenges right now. It's so difficult to try and determine what problem are we trying to solve in healthcare, because there's so many things that contribute, multi-factors that contribute to the problem in the first place. How do you even begin to understand how to unravel that? And we do spend a lot of time as CEOs talking to each other about what's the problem we're trying to solve. Mm.
Well, it's that complex adaptive system again, you know, rearing its ugly head or its natural head. So I'm not sure if you're aware, but I'm actually a big fan of talking about failures or missteps, because oftentimes leaders' bios sound like they were born into privileged roles. You know, do you have an example of maybe a failure or something that didn't work out that as you thought it would be, that you'd like to share maybe and talk about what it taught you?
I had a great boss early days who would always tell me it's all about the recovery. I mean, this was a consultant who I had worked with, and she would often talk to me about, yeah, things are going to screw up. Things won't always go as they will, but it's all about the recovery. And I actually think that's a very apt sort of idiom for people to think about. The story was during the pandemic, actually, and we were in a position where in southwestern Ontario, we had a number of agricultural workers who were part of the foreign agricultural worker program. These are people who come in on a seasonal basis, seasonal farm workers, work the farm, send money back to their families back in their home countries, and then eventually make their way back as well, only to return again to work in these greenhouses, et cetera. A real backbone for the agricultural industry down in southwestern Ontario. But because they are temporary foreign workers, did not have all the same rights, and I'll say access to health services that most Canadians would have had during the pandemic. This actually resulted in the death of two individuals down in southwestern Ontario during the early parts of the pandemic. And as someone who was leading the IMS, I was asked to step in and try and solve this. And what was really interesting about this particular population and sad was they were managed by about 10 different ministries at the federal, provincial, municipal level, multiple levels of government. And because of that, nobody really had accountability for these individuals. And so as we were working through the solutions, I went to my boss and I said, here's what we need in order to take care of these people so this doesn't happen again. We just couldn't get all of those different stakeholders aligned to say, yes, do it. And then my boss called me on one evening after I'd asked for these things, and he said, Mark, no help is coming. Right. Now, that's a really dire statement for your boss to deliver to you. And I said, well, what do I do? And he said, and this is Matt Anderson at Ontario Health, so I have no problem telling this story because I think it was a really defining moment for me in terms of what leadership looks like. And he said to me, Mark, I will never fault somebody for an active commission if it's done in the right spirit and for the right reason. And he said, so go do what you need to do to take care of these people, right? And so he empowered me. He effectively said, you know, he didn't give me a blank check. I wasn't going to be irresponsible about this, but he empowered me to make solutions where there were none, to take authority where I had to, and to act. And we did. And we created isolation spaces. We created a sort of food program for these folks. We had primary care coming in and doing the checking and all that sort of stuff. And I would say, from a moment of complete and abject failure where I could not rally the support that was required in order to get help to these people, despite all the reasoning and, you know, there was a failure there that I was not able to convey to folks that this needed to be done. But through an act of leadership, I believe, and an empowerment of the people that worked for him, this particular boss created the conditions for success. And we did. And no other temporary foreign workers died after that from our interventions. They got connected to primary care. They got what they needed. They got access to vaccines. Or the lesson for me was leadership matters, right? Being empowered, having somebody who will have your back in that moment was a really, really key thing. And I learned a lot from it.
Yeah. And knowing when you can actually, I'd say, have a little bit of, as you say, leverage to or privilege to be able to go into that sort of gray space as well, that's sort of the cracks between systems that you have to actually take that leadership role. So well done on that.
Well, and you know, I will say, when you learn that, you can pay it forward, right? So the people that report to you and the people that report to them, like, this is one of those things with leadership, is it trickles down. And I tell this story often because I think it's a really important lesson. Is that if you have the right people in place and you give them the empowerment to do what they need to do, you'll probably be in pretty good shape. If they work by the values and ultimately the best interests of the people they're serving, you should be in pretty good shape.
No, I love that, putting values at the center of in principles at the center of everything you're doing. We hear a lot about this thing called AI.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you see that's going to actually, you know, transform the hospital and healthcare? And I'm not going to hold you to this, Mark, but you know, there's so much in this space that's happening, and you know, I know it's a consideration that everyone's doing in their planning ahead.
Without question. And I think the public, you know, you asked me the question before, what would people be surprised about? I actually think people would be surprised about the amount of AI that's already in place, by the way, in hospitals. And so in the moment, I can talk about our MRI scanners have AI built right into them. And you can imagine a MRI is really something that takes pictures and slices. And through its computer processing power, it's capable of then extrapolating how those all run together. Well, AI fills in the blanks in between, as an example, right? When it's doing the image rendering, it's filling in some of those blanks. So AI is with us and we use it already. But, you know, I think people are really, as they're using ChatGPT or other things, like, how do those things adapt? And I would say in the immediate, there's a couple of different ways. One is just in how physicians do documentation, as an example. They spend a lot of time writing in charts, taking notes, et cetera. They now have these AI scribes that can effectively listen to the doctor as he or she is speaking to their patient and take all of that chat, extract from it the discussion about the Blue Jays, the Maple Leafs, and maybe what they had for dinner last night, and pull out the clinically relevant things and immediately document into the hospital information system. And that's more time away from paperwork and more time with patients. So I'd say that is a real thing that is happening now. Now there's always privacy and a whole bunch of other concerns that you've got to work around, and we take those very seriously. But I would say that's one area. The other one that I would say is, I don't think that you will see AI in the next 5 years doing the job of a doctor. That's not what I believe is responsible or appropriate, because, well, you can say something to a terminal or to an algorithm and give it facts. There's so much more to medicine than just what the patient says. It's how they say it. It's what they look like, the color, the color of their eyes, the way they're breathing, the way they're sitting. There's a bunch of subtle nonverbal pieces that come through as well. And so what I would say is I think that AI in the meantime will be good at flagging things for physicians to think about. A great example of this is down at Unity Health in Toronto, was they felt that they were missing things like intracranial bleeds. People were presenting migraines, blurred vision, variety of other things, and their sense was they were missing things called intracranial bleeds, small vascular anomalies that are happening and can turn out to be quite serious. And as they talked about this, they talked about the fact that the human doctor can really only process 7, 8, maybe 9 variables at once. And as such, there's a limitation in terms of all the things that they could be running through in terms of that differential diagnosis they're trying to create. But AI is capable of looking at hundreds of variables at once, not to make a decision, but to say, hey, doctor, maybe you should take a look over here because this one has enough of the necessary conditions that this might be worth an investigation. Now, I believe that's where we get smart, because if we get that flag, it tees us in to say, perhaps that's something we should be looking at. And in fact, they found that they reduced the number of missed intracranial bleeds by 80% in doing that. So wasn't diagnosing it, but it was saying, hey, this is somebody that's worth looking at just to make sure, that sober second thought. And I would say to you, that's where I see the opportunity in the immediate term, Daniel, is not to replace the clinician, but to give them an additional tool that says, here's a number of things that are presenting. And in typical, consistent way, this is the type of patient that you might want to consider, or a differential diagnosis that might be worth investigating. And then they can do what they're best at, which is the art of medicine and digging into the other subtler things.
I think I've heard other people say that they think that it may affect some of your back office things like finance systems and call centers and those types of things. But you'll always need, the primary care, physicians and nurses and all those folks as well.
And when you really think about it, I think I said it earlier, I don't get a lot of complaints. When I do get complaints, it's generally not about the technology we're using, the clinical protocols that we're using. It has nothing to do with the actual science of medicine. It's usually how we treated people, how they felt about their care. Was I treated as a human or just the HIPAA number 6? And what I would say to you is AI cannot step into that space. The provision of care, the connection of care, can't be done through a terminal. That can only be done through a connection between one human being and another. And I say that doesn't mean that we have to be present for every single element of it, but I do still believe there is a sacred nature of the therapeutic relationship between a provider and a patient that can't be beat by AI in any stretch.
Well, that's comforting. That's for certain. So we'll see what the future unfolds, but it's comforting to hear your thoughts on that. Now, this has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed it and hope you have too. But wonder if there's anything else you'd like to share maybe about some thoughts for leaders in messy environments and trying to think about, joining an institution like yours?
Yeah, we've touched on this, so it might be a little bit of a summary of some of the points that we've already talked about, Daniel. But, kind of going back to what I think is ultimately the goal of a leader, the goal of a leader is much like the goal of, as I said before, the conductor, right? Here's what we want to achieve, right? We're going to play a little blues tune here. It's going to, go to this timing and, be about this long, and it should kind of have this general vibe, and here's the chord structure. But within that, go do your thing. Go be brilliant. You're a brilliant musician. You're a brilliant clinician. You're a brilliant whatever. Hire smarter people. And this was one of the true lessons I think that I learned throughout my things. You don't have to be the smartest person in the room, but you need to know how to identify those who are and get them rallied and sitting around that table. And I will say I have stood on the shoulders of giants when it comes to their intellect. I am seldom the smartest person in the room, but I can get them around the table and I can describe a problem and a reason why it's going to make a difference. And that's my strength. But the intellectual horsepower comes from other people, people who know this business. And I say, so hire smart people. Don't worry if they're smarter than you. They probably should be, to be honest with you. And I would say that's one piece. I would say the other one is that, and I mentioned this before as well, just like good music, you got to put some silence into your into that music. There's got to be some rests, right? You cannot have an entire symphony where people are just going hard. There are moments of crescendo. There are moments where you are pianissimo, right? There are times where you are silent. And as leaders, we have to be silent once in a while, not only in our language, but I would say also in, we need to take downtime. We need to rest. And there's a time where you just sit back and you need to rest. I don't think we do that well enough. And that's why you are seeing so much burnout, I'd say, in society in general. People don't know how to rest. And I guess the other thing, if we go back to this notion of complex adaptive systems, you can't script every moment, right? Like you cannot possibly come up with the algorithm or the sheet music that would suggest that this is exactly how it's going to go. People are imperfect. Systems are imperfect. The human animal that walks through my door at the hospital wounded is not the same person who normally sits at their kitchen table when feeling well and happy and content. They are anxious and they are in pain. That's an unpredictable person. And I would say for us, the best we can do as leaders is kind of just set the tone, lead with values, talk about what an active commission really means at the end of the day. Like, what is it that we're trying to achieve here? What are the values we're going to use to do that? And honestly, get out of the way, because most people know exactly what they need to do in those moments. And I would say maybe that's the biggest lesson I've taken from almost all of my career, is let the smart people do their jobs, because they know exactly what they're there to do. And if they're led with the right mission and the right values, you're probably going to end up in the right space.
And it comes back to that Kierkegaard quote in some ways, that, you know, we'll only know how things are successful by looking backwards as well, and take a look after the case. Go with your best interests, you know, jump in with your instrument when you need to, with your guitar for the solo. But I love to leave the space for silence too, and pauses, and I think that's so important.
Yeah, the soul needs rest. I think the mind needs rest. And we don't do enough to, as human beings, I think, to preserve that. And I would say, you know, we're also anxious for that perfect day when things just calm down in any industry. It never does. It never does. There's always change. And, you know, there's this notion that we somehow want to get to perfection. But I think perfection is brittle, beautiful, flawed, can evolve. And I think that's the nature of the health system. I think it's a beautiful, noble profession. It's why I wanted to get into it. It's why I cried when I became a CEO, because I believe this was a calling, something to do, to help. And as flawed as it is, I also see it as beautiful. And I do see it always evolving. And it's not the same day. And we move some days inches, some days feet. But I think we're always getting better, and we're always committed to trying to get better.
I love that. And I tell people actually who are in roles similar to you that on the days when you've had a great day, do a voice recording or write it down, because, you know, sometimes you actually may need to listen to that or look at what you've written in your thoughts when you're having a dark day, to remember actually that you do have these wonderful, wonderful days with great things happening.
I agree. And we so often, you know, it's one of the challenges of leaders, I think, is we often get all of the biggest problems. And for me in particular, right, like I'm the last stop on the problem train. And if they can't be solved by the rest of the organization, the ones that show up on my desk are pretty significant. These are big problems that smart people could not figure out. And that also gives you a very perverted view, a very distorted view of what's actually going on in your organization, because all I see are problems on a daily basis. You got to know that great things are happening in your organization, and you've got to go looking for those as well, because otherwise you can really get jaded and burnt out if you only believe that problems are happening. And it is a lesson that I continue to learn. Great things happen every day, and you got to find them because they are happening.
Love that. Love that. And what a great note to end this on. So thanks so much, Mark. I've really enjoyed and learned a lot from this conversation. So thank you so much.
It was my absolute pleasure. It was messy, but I enjoyed it a great deal. Thanks, Daniel.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Mark about one of the messiest systems we have, a community hospital under relentless pressure. I appreciate the focus on the emotional reality of 24/7 care, the long shadow of the pandemic, and why hospitals and universities are not broken corporations. They are rather a different species of mission-driven organization, with constant trade-offs between funding, demand, and human need. One of the themes we kept circling back to is leadership in complex adaptive systems and what it looks like to hold complexity rather than solve it for once and for all. And I loved Mark's metaphor about leading more like a jazz conductor than a classical maestro, setting the structure and the values, then getting out of the way so smart people can improvise and do their best work. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And if you did, please write a quick review and share it with someone you think who would enjoy it. After all, getting through the mess is easier with others.